Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In Tehran, it's the chant of God is great versus the Islamic revolution. So what's the role of religion in a crisis when both sides invoke God? We will ask Reza Aslan, author of How to Win a Cosmic War, and we'll talk generally about the situation in Iran with him. He's University of California professor, and he is fresh from his appearance with Jon Stewart last night. Professor Aslan, welcome back to WNYC.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me back again.
I missed you on The Daily Show. Were you funny?
Well, you know, it's a little bit hard to be funny about Iran these days,
Jon
Stewart always figures out some way to do so.
Now, the Iranian government sees itself as an Islamic revolutionary government. What does God or what does Islam have to do with the way the Iranian government is run at this point?
Well, I mean, it is the ideological basis of the government. Iran's got a very unusual, very innovative form of government that envisions actually almost two parallel governments. There is a usually freely elected president, an elected parliament, and a fairly independent judiciary, exactly what one would expect in a constitutional democratic society. But then there is this shadow government on top of that that is made up primarily of non-elected groups within the clerical regime. And this includes the supreme leader, who was originally meant to be more like a pope-like figure, somebody who would have moral authority, but not direct political authority, though certainly political influence. And then a host of Orwellian subcommittees with these wonderful names like the Assembly of Experts or the Council of Guardians. And their job was to facilitate power between the elected government and the unelected clerics. And in this way, there was supposed to be a balance that was struck between maintaining popular sovereignty and the sovereignty of God. This is what was, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini, the man who kind of came up with this government. It was his way of reconciling, you know, the Islam and democracy. But what happened is that almost immediately after this government was put into place, Saddam Hussein attacked Iran. And what started was an eight-year-long devastating war, the longest nation war in the 20th century. And during that time, along with a series of amendments to the Constitution, power began to be more or less centralized within the non-elected part of the government as opposed to the elected part. And nowadays, the supreme leader, who is today a man by the name of Ali Khamenei. He is not just sort of the moral authority of the state, but he's also the commander-in-chief of the army.
Right.
He has the right to veto any law. He is in charge of foreign policy. He can dismiss the president if he'd likes. And really what you're seeing on the streets of Iran now, this reform movement, isn't so much a discussion about getting rid of the government altogether or getting rid of the Islamic Republic altogether. Basically, what it is let's return back to the core of what the Islamic Republic was supposed to be, which is more republic, less Islamic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and a New York Times article today says power has been shifting in Iran away from the mullahs to the security apparatus. You think that's true?
Yes, in fact, I've gone so far as to call the stolen elections a military coup. What happened was that in 2005, when Ahmadinejad first won the presidency, he did so because he had the backing of the Revolutionary Guard. Now, the Revolutionary Guard is this sort of military security apparatus within Iran. We don't have anything like it in the United States, so it's hard to imagine the power of this group. But if you could imagine if we had the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the CIA all rolled into one, that's what the Revolutionary Guard represents in Iran. And they were originally created to be the supreme leader's personal militia. After the 79 revolution, I think the clerics realized that they couldn't really trust the military because most of these guys were the Shah's men. So they basically created their own parallel military, and that was the Revolutionary Guard. But over the last decade or so, the Revolutionary Guard has become increasingly strong and have begun to increasingly act like an independent agent, so that they've kind of been very slowly pushing the clerics aside, pushing the supreme leader aside. And thanks to Ahmadinejad, who himself was a member of the Revolutionary Guard, they've begun to infiltrate the political establishment so that they are now, you know, about a third of the parliament now is members of the Revolutionary Guard. They're also very rich, is the other thing, Brian, that I think is important to understand. They control about a third of the Iranian economy thanks to their various subsidiaries with regard to oil and natural gas and real estate. And in many ways, they have completely, you know, married themselves to Ahmadinejad. They mm-hmm. really represent a single force now. In fact, some people would say that Ahmadinejad is nothing but a puppet for the Revolutionary Guard.
It's a police state in the name of God.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why we're seeing this split within the clerical regime itself, with some high-ranking, very influential members of the clergy, like the Ayatollah Rafsanjani, who's probably the second most powerful man in Iran after the supreme leader, taking the side of the protesters, taking the side of the reform movement, because I think what they're saying is, look, it's the Islamic Republic, the way that we envisioned it, that's under attack here. There's a real fear that Iran is becoming a military state. And so you're seeing what some within the Mousavi camp have referred to the elections and the way that they were stolen as an act of treason against the state, which is why we're seeing these strange coalitions forming between, you know, mullahs and young students, mm-hmm. between conservatives and reformists.
And we can take some phone calls for Reza Aslan, author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror, 212-433-WNYC. Or you can post a comment or a question on our webpage, as always, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But our phone number, 212-433-9692. By the way, to digress for just a minute, speaking of police state-like activities, here is some more detail on the Supreme Court decision just handed down. The Supreme Court has ruled that a school's strip search of an Arizona teenage girl accused of having prescription-strength ibuprofen was illegal. The court ruled on Thursday, or just this morning, a short while ago, that school officials violated the law with their search of Savannah Redding, who lives in Safford, Arizona, in the rural eastern part of the state. Redding, who now attends college, was 13 at the time when officials at Safford Middle School ordered her to remove her clothes and shake out her underwear because they were looking for pills, ibuprofen. Again, the district bans prescription and over-the-counter drugs, and the school was acting on a tip from another student. So that much-awaited decision in from the Supreme Court. There are some details of it, and we'll be talking to Emily Bazelon from Slate.com in a little while for the implications. But we continue with Reza Aslan. Reza, with what we were just discussing, does this leave religion sort of meaningless in the whole affair? If one side invokes God on their side and the other side that wants the opposite result invokes God on their side, where does that leave God but a creation of man?
Well, you know, on the contrary, far from it being meaningless, I think you recognize that, you know, religion is always going to be a powerful force to communicate, you know, human desires and aspirations. It is, after all, the language of religion that holds the most currency for the masses. All you have to do is look at the way that we in the United States talk about the most, you know, legal issues that, you know, really shouldn't have anything to do with religion, but which are discussed almost exclusively in moral terms. I mean, I've never heard anyone give me a legal reason why two men who love each other can't get married. You know, it's all about morality. And so you're seeing that in Iran as well. The one thing that I should say, though, that I think would be interesting to your listeners, that midnight shout of Allahu Akbar that rings from rooftop to rooftop, and that has done so every night for the past 9 or 10 days.
That chant that we played at the top of the segment.
That is a throwback to something that happened in 1979 when the revolution was taking place against the Shah. People would go up to their rooftops and shout, God is great and death to the dictator, as a way of sort of, as almost like a beacon, a way of telling everybody else, you know, in the city, you're not alone. You know, keep going. It's a long road. You know, we will triumph. And the fact that that has been taken up by the reformists, that they're also shouting death to the dictator and God is great, is a way, it's a subtle message to the regime that you have become the Shah, that the people that brought down the Shah 30 years ago, that brought down the dictator 30 years ago, have now become the dictator. It's a very powerful message.
Let's listen just a minute. With a lot of emotion, obviously, being carried by that chant in the streets, correct?
And if you can imagine, you know, during the daylight hours, the police and the Revolutionary Guard ruled the streets. But at night, in the anonymity of darkness, on the tops of these roofs where no one can see you, I mean, these shouts are a way of essentially letting everyone know that, you know, this revolution is still going, it's still strong.
Nicholas in Queens wants to challenge at least one thing you said. Nicholas, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi there. I'm just wondering, because it seems to me that this discussion proceeds from the assumption that there was fraud and that it did change the result. And I'm wondering, how is that known for sure? And it seems to me, as an outsider, granted, that Ahmadinejad was enormously popular outside Tehran, and there were a lot of polls showing him ahead by a 2-to-1 margin, including by Western groups. So I'm wondering, how do we know for sure, and can we really proceed from the assumption that Ahmadinejad did not win?
It certainly is still a very fair question. And Reza, I must say, you went further than a lot of the other guests that we've had over these 10 days or so, who have said, well, look, of course, we can't say that the election was stolen. I don't know that we could ever prove it. There is this piece of evidence and that piece of evidence. But you just out and out called it a stolen election.
Well, let's put it this way. First, let me talk about the poll that he's talking about, because it was done by a very good friend of mine, Ken Ballin, who does very strong polls in Iran. Now, as he himself has admitted, he did this poll 3 weeks before the election process even began. Now, you have to understand that the elections in Iran last 4 weeks and 4 weeks only. No one can begin to campaign before those 4 weeks start, and when those 4 weeks end, the campaigning has to stop. So taking a poll of Iranian views 3 weeks before, you know, the election begins is sort of equivalent to taking a poll of Americans' views about who they're going to vote for, you know, in like January of 07, to that effect. So that poll was, I think, somewhat problematic. Now, Ahmadinejad does have a lot of support in the villages and amongst the rural poor. I think the reason that people look, he asked for evidence. So this is what I can tell you. Well, we know for a fact that his numbers in those regions, in the rural poor and the villages, remained constant, and that the number of new voters were all young voters and were all in the urban elite, which are, you know, natural constituencies for the reformists. And by the way, 526, the group that did some great polling in the American presidential election, has also done a good analysis of this, and I do recommend their website.
538.
538,
right?
I'm sorry. 538.
Yeah, Nate Silver, 538.com. And folks, that's a great website. You have to spell out the words. You can't write the numbers. You have to write out 538.com.
But let's just put it this way. I mean, we're to believe that he won by a 2-to-1 margin across the board, not just in the villages, but in Tehran, in all of the major cities. I mean, he got consistently 66% to 68% in every single category, at every single age group, in every single ethnicity. That's a little bit difficult to believe. Secondly, he won his Mousavi's hometown of Azerbaijan in Tabriz by 80%. Now, Mousavi is an ethnic Azeri, and and the Azeris only vote for their own people. As an Azeri friend of mine said, this would be akin to John McCain having won the African-American vote in Harlem.
Although, I get it. Ahmadinejad's people say he speaks Azeri, and he's got long ties to the Azeri community, too.
So Ahmadinejad, 4 years ago, also ran for president. There were six people who ran for president, including one Azeri, who came in sixth, and the only region that he won was Azerbaijan.
Good evidence.
The other thing, too, my favorite statistics, I just have to say, is that in the city of Lorestan, which is Mehdi Karoubi, the other reformist candidate's hometown, if you believe the official figures, Karoubi got fewer votes in his hometown than the number of volunteers he had working for him. And let's not forget that this election was called within 2 hours of the polls closing.
Right.
50 million votes,
right,
all of which have to be counted by hand.
Paper ballots.
That's hard to believe.
All right. We're almost out of time. A couple of things really, really quick. You have been outspoken in your support of President Obama's restrained utterances on the Iran situation since the election. Did you hear a material change in his news conference the other day? Was he pressured by Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham and the like? And at what point, in your own opinion, does being kind of laissez-faire on this become obsolete for the United States?
Well, I don't think that it was due to pressure. I think it was really just a gradual progression of you know, what he's been saying all along, precisely because once the government cracked down, you know, the way that it did, I mean, he had to speak out against the violence being used. And I think what you're going to hear is Obama continue to speak out strongly against the use of force and against the use of violence. We're in a bit of a bind. This is probably about the worst thing that could have happened with regard to the United States, because we really do need Iran for a whole host of things, from Iraq to Afghanistan to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And even if this settles down, even if, you know, things go back to normal and Ahmadinejad, you know, is sworn in, it's going to be very difficult to deal directly with a government that whose own people consider to be illegitimate. I really don't know where Obama goes from here,
yeah,
but this may have put a real crink in our plans to open up dialogue with the Islamic Republic.
I hear you. And you know what? I'm going to extend this segment just a little bit, because we have somebody who says he actually voted in the Iran elections.
Great.
And that is Azeen in Brooklyn. Azeen, thank you so much for calling us.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call, Ryan. I myself am an Iranian American. I was born and raised in the United States, but recently acquired Iranian citizenship, which allowed me to vote. And when I went to vote here in Manhattan, I noticed, even as a layperson who doesn't understand, who doesn't know what international standards are for a free and fair election, that it was quite, there were some irregularities or things that were inappropriate. For example, there was no private place at which we could cast our ballot. We had to share a table with several other people who were also voting. They could hear what I was saying, what I could hear what they were saying. We all had to rely on just one piece of paper on which the names of the candidates were listed, as well as coded numbers that corresponded to the name of the candidate. And on that piece of paper, numbers were scratched out, numbers were filled in. There was a great deal of confusion as to what name corresponded with which number. And my husband read in a newspaper in Iran that reported that, in fact, there was confusion about the codes. For example, Ahmadinejad was, let's say, 44, and Mousavi was 54 or 65. But because our number listed Mousavi as corresponding with number 4, it could have been counted as, in fact, for Ahmadinejad. So there was indeed confusion. There was no privacy. And this was a space here in the United States.
It sounds exactly what happened with Pat Buchanan and Al Gore on those butterfly ballots in Florida.
There you go. Lots of commonalities.
Reza, had you heard that particular allegation?
Yes, actually, it was that Mousavi, his number was 4, and Ahmadinejad's number was 44, which was sort of bizarre. But more importantly, I have to tell you that that her vote did not count. That's the other thing that's important to understand, is that you're supposed to take 3 days to certify the ballots, and there's no way that this massive overseas vote of Iranians who were voting outside of Iran, that there's no way that those ballots were counted in the 2 hours that it took for them to call the election for Ahmadinejad.
How does that make you feel, Azeen?
Disappointed, angry, violated. Just a couple of hours after we cast our vote, the evening of June 12th, we got the news that Ahmadinejad had won, and clearly we knew that something was wrong there. Just, again, as a layperson, not understanding the system, we know that something was wrong. And the anger, it resonates quite strongly.
Thank you very much for chiming in.
Can I just say, Brian, in closing, that although all of this is obviously very important, this is no longer about an election.
Right.
That this is now
about
something
basic,
much bigger.
Basic freedom of expression, correct?
That's right.
Ability to assemble peacefully without being beaten up or killed by the government.
And it's also about the future of the country itself, the very legitimacy of the country. It stopped being about an election about a week ago.
But Rezan, let me finish here, because I saw you on TV last week being very upbeat about the prospects for change in Iran. Just as President Obama's rhetoric seems to have progressed with events, have you now been sobered by events?
Well, I have been sobered by events, but I also want to say that, you know, I keep talking about 1979 and the revolution that brought down the Shah. You know, that revolution took a year. There were a lot of ups and downs, a lot of ebbs and flows, times in which it seemed the government was going to win, times at which it seemed that the people was going to win. This is a very long process. It's a chess match, really, at this point. So I think we're just seeing the beginnings of this. You know, the past couple of days have been hard. It's been hard to watch the brutality with which the government has cracked down on the protesters. But this is not over yet. This is not over by any means.
Reza Aslan, University of California professor and author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. Let's keep talking, okay? Thank you very much.
Anytime.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll continue in a minute looking at how Google has introduced a new tool to help keep information flowing from Iran. Stay tuned.